One of the boxes. Nice. Okay.
And
the button to go up and down is just right here. That's it? Okay. Oh, that's super nice. I don't know where you want it, but I'll just leave it there. And you're talking about the light, that little digital.
Yeah, there's a light up there by the clock.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
Judge Werke,
Judge Ross, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat, please. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two matters scheduled on our calendar today for oral consideration argument, July 26, 2023. Before going further, I'll ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes, of course, to argue your case in chief. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. And when you're ready, appellate counsel, you can approach the podium.
Good Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Ann Morris Carlson, and I represent Appellant Father P.C. We are asking that this court would reverse the district court's order transferring physical and legal custody of child to the foster parents. This case presents two legal questions. The first question that strikes me is, what are the efforts that are owed to the non-custodial parent when the custodial parent voluntarily places the child in foster care? 260C.219, when a child is in foster care, the responsible social service agency shall, not optional, shall make diligent efforts to locate and, where appropriate, offer services to both parents of the child. They are to offer a case plan within 30 days of removal. I assume that case plan needs to be a case plan that assists father in becoming situated to have the child placed in his care. I assume that it has to be a case plan pursuant to Minnesota Statute 260C.212. And I'm only concerned about case plans that are ordered by the court. I'm not concerned about voluntary.
It'll help me if you use the microphone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for that. I have a lot of papers here that I'm trying to keep on top of. I'm concerned about case plans that are ordered by the court, that are signed by the parent, that are made jointly with the parent, that reflect that the parent understands, based on conversations with social services, what efforts they need to make to have to assume day-to-day custody of the child. The agency, the other legal issue that I think that this case brings is where the presumption of parental fitness meets the best interests of the child. And I will concede I could be persuaded that the best interests of the child may be enough to overcome the presumption of palpable unfitness established in Klugman, 1959, but the district court did not make those findings. I'm asking this court to find that the efforts that were put forth by the social service agency with regard to my client were not reasonable. They did not provide a case plan within 30 days. The case plans that they provided were vague at best. I concede that the original, June 2021 case plan did note that father was to participate in drug testing. Drug testing, of course, is not efforts to assist a parent. It is only informative of whether use exists. And this is a case where there was some discussion that possibly at times, or at one point in time, child may have returned to the foster home smelling of marijuana, but there wasn't a finding that father's use interfered with his ability to care for the child and provide a safe home for her. The findings about...
Let me ask a question. You know, overall, he has a plan March 21, June 21. He has a plan July 22, which that's a different argument because of the timing of it, that your argument is he didn't have enough time to demonstrate compliance. But tell us what obligation he has, if any, to say, you know, here's the plan, I don't get it, help me correct something. Where's his burden? Where's his involvement in this that he should challenge the social worker presenting the plan and say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, I'm lost?
The presumption... rebutting the presumption rests upon those who challenge
it. Just to be clear, I don't think this is a question about the presumption. It seems this is a question about whether the argument was made that there's
duty.
A deficiency in the case plan during those review hearings, those 90-day review hearings, where he has an opportunity to ask the court to add things to the case plan, to take things out of the case plan. So there's all of that management phase. And at that point, I didn't see any evidence or anything in the record that father challenged the sufficiency or the specificity of the case plan. I think that's what the question was getting to, not the presumption.
I think that the two work together, but I understand the differentiation. And in focusing on the case plan, father did challenge the case plan. That's the reason that He challenged it in the underlying CHIPS proceedings. He challenged it when they initially filed the petition to transfer custody to the foster parents, and he highlighted the requirements of Minnesota Statute 260C.219. Of course, the case that I'm asking this court to review is the permanency case where the court transferred physical and legal custody, presumably from the agency, to the foster parents. But the agency skipped a step by not meaningfully assessing father's ability to provide day-to-day care. And the agency's concerns here are not do not rise to a level where there could be a finding that father is unfit to parent, doesn't have toys or books available, doesn't...
I want to go back to your reference to the child smelling of marijuana. You seem to suggest that had no bearing on the qualities of the parenting?
Your Honor, when I looked at the case plan and when I presented in good faith to this court that my first read of the first case plan did not indicate that there was a need to address substance use, it was because I had to continue reading a little bit more deeply. And father is not as...
You seem to be suggesting that the child smelling of drugs was not enough to warrant a concern about father's drug use with regard to his parenting. And I want to just try to understand the basis of your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Child smelling of marijuana, which I understand was a one-time thing that they discussed with father, and then it wasn't an issue going forward, and then they gave him unsupervised visitation for several hours at a time, which would indicate that his marijuana usage in and of itself does not present as a safety risk to the child. I think that if the agency did have legitimate concerns about father's marijuana usage being a safety risk, that there would be more of a requirement than simply slipping into the case plan that he should participate in drug testing.
Well, that wouldn't the testing give the agency more information about whether it was, as you describe it, something that is relatively insignificant or whether there's something that's more concerning?
Had he participated in it? What I'm not seeing in this record is that there were meaningful conversations with father about the importance of complying with the case
plan. I want
to go
back to my question. I wasn't sure whether you were planning on answering that.
Yep.
Would testing help inform those concerned about the relationship between father and child and father's drug use, as it relates to father's drug use? Wouldn't they become more informed about whether the problem was significant if you participated in testing?
Participating in testing would inform them if the problem is significant, yes. Ultimately, I believe that they moved towards unsupervised visitation because the problem was not significant, I presume, but I don't fault them or hold it against them that they moved to unsupervised visitation. And I will say from the district court's order, I don't believe the court gave much weight to the drug testing other than to weigh in on the fact that it was a part of a case plan that father agreed to. But if the concern is that his use is problematic or is the reason that child cannot be placed with him, providing a telephone number for drug testing for him to call is not an effort to reunify. All the testing does is indicate use.
His last plan was in July 2022, and you're arguing now that he didn't have enough time to, because things were happening, that he didn't have enough time to comply with what the plan had. Did you raise that in district court? Is this before us properly, or was it not raised in district court?
Your Honor, in father's closing arguments, he made arguments about the case plan. Father's closing, page 13. He made arguments about drug testing, also on page 13, and arguments about the case plan on page 7 of the closing arguments. Father's arguments about the case plan are couched a little bit differently than mine. But father did argue that the case plan... Father's argument is that the agency determined that the foster parents were a better fit for this child from the get and that the agency didn't make meaningful efforts to assist father in becoming able.
I totally understand your argument. You feel as it was a foregone conclusion, child was going to go with foster parents, and that they just kind of swept father under the rug. But as far as the argument to the trial court, we need to know that the district court considered the fact that here's a new plan, it's June 2022, and here's the plan, and did you articulate on his behalf that this isn't enough time for me to do what needs to be done?
Father's trial counsel argued that there should...
Did father's trial counsel ask for a continuance?
I can't answer that. I don't believe, based on my read, that the continuance was requested on the basis of we need more time to comply with the case plan, but...
What about as I understand it, on appeal, the primary argument that you're making regarding the case plan is that the case plan does not explicitly state that father needed to demonstrate an understanding of the child's needs. And absent some express statement like that, there was a deficiency in the case plan that would preclude the district court from making its determinations. But I didn't see where father's trial counsel made that argument below. It seems like the first time we're hearing this argument that the case plan was deficient because it doesn't say anything about specifically, expressly, that father needs to, quote, demonstrate an understanding of the child's needs, close quote. Where was that argued below?
I am advancing arguments in a somewhat different direction than were the arguments that were advanced by trial counsel, because I'm coming into the case late and I'm saying that I believe that the case plan needs to comply with the statutory requirement, and that for the agency to make reasonable efforts in a transfer of custody, I can't find case law about a transfer of custody and what the reasonable efforts need to look like. I can't find published case law regarding, are there different efforts that are applied when there's a transfer of physical and legal custody than when there's a termination of parental rights? I think if this was a termination of parental rights, I would easily argue we have all sorts of precedent that says that this case plan is not sufficient. I don't care about case plans that aren't ordered by the district court.
Our review, of course, is abuse of discretion. So if there are arguments presented, as you say, in a different way or a different direction than those presented in the district court, on what ground would we say the district court abused its discretion by failing to recognize positions that weren't presented?
I am saying that trial counsel did comment on the case plan, though less specifically argued against the case plan than I did, and that trial counsel did argue the case plan in the underlying CHIPS proceeding, that the original case plan, when the agency withdrew its initial TLC petition, trial counsel made the argument, you didn't give him a case plan, you didn't give him a meaningful opportunity, you didn't assess him pursuant to 260C.219. That argument got made. And then case plans came later, and in reviewing the case plans, I find that they lack specificity, and I find that the record lacks an indication that reasonable efforts were made to assess father's ability to provide day-to-day care for this child. I appreciate that the agency didn't move forward with a termination of parental rights and that it chose a transfer of physical and legal custody, but I don't believe in reading the statutes that there's any authority to suggest that the efforts that are owed to the parent are less.
What's the clearest path for us to disagree with respondent that your argument has been forfeited by failure to having raised it in the district court?
The interests of justice require that this court would clarify the law in regard to what efforts are owed to a non-custodial parent when there is a transfer of physical and legal custody, because the law is currently unclear.
So you'd like this to be a precedential opinion?
I am asking for a precedential opinion that would establish that there needs to be a meaningful case plan provided within 30 days of the child's removal, and the authority I have for that is statute. I'm looking at 260C.219, 260C.212. I want a case plan that is ordered by the district court and that is discussed with the father prior to getting his signature. I am concerned about any case plans that indicate to me that they were mailed to the father or provided with to the father, or that they weren't discussed with the father at the time that they were written. I see that
time has expired, but you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal after we hear from respondent counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court. I'm Christos Jensen, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the Ramsey County Social Services Department, representing Ramsey County in this appeal as respondent. Your Honors, today, what I'm requesting on behalf of Ramsey County is that this court dismiss appellant's appeal and affirm the district court's decision, namely finding that, one, the trial court did not abuse its discretion by determining...
If I can interrupt, Mr. Jensen,
yes.
You know, and I know you're trying to help us with the roadmap, but I think the first question I have is, as you argue in your brief, that the appellant's argument regarding the case plan requirements... That was something that has been forfeited. So I'd like you to start there and maybe address what appellant counsel has said to us in oral argument, that there was something in the father's closing argument that would have been sufficient to preserve appellate review of the case plan requirements in 30 days and service versus mail and when the signature is required and all of those requirements that would typically apply in a TPR case.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the argument that was presented to the court, as the court indicates, at no point during this case was that issue raised. From the agency's perspective, at every hearing, the court in 7 consecutive hearings had affirmed the case plan. 260C-219 was raised by the attorney for respondent, but not in the way that was cited and presented to the court today. So as Your Honor is specifically requesting about the 30-day requirement and about specificity in the case plans, those issues were not argued to the best of my recollection, and I don't have any place in the record to cite for Your Honors that
you know,
occurred.
And I appreciate where you're at, and you obviously briefed that very well, but we've now heard from appellant counsel, and she says, interests of justice. I mean, we have a father and we have a child, and these are fundamental matters of importance. So how do you respond to that we should consider this, or at least let the district court consider it on a remand, because these are significant issues?
Well, that's certainly at the discretion of this panel of determining where this panel would like to go. Respectfully, the agency does not support that and does not believe that this case merits that level of review. Alternatively, if this court were to go in and look at the case plans of what was filed, as Your Honor cited, there was a March 2021, June 2021. There was also an April 2022 in addition to the July 2022 case plan. So there were 4 case plans. In March of 21, that case plan was presented to appellant. He did not ultimately sign it. That case plan was revised. And in June of 2021 was presented in person, mailed to appellant, and filed with the district court. There was also testimony that appellant met with his counsel to review that case plan but still refused to sign it. I would note that under the case plan, there are 8 domains. So there's that statement that
awareness, it's been some time since I've been physically as a trial judge on these cases. Do caseworkers no longer meet with a parent and go over the plan?
They do, and that was a temp.
You indicated it was mailed, and I didn't know if that is the some contact by a social worker. Is here's your plan, it's in the mail, figure it out.
No, there was extensive testimony at the trial and also at hearings throughout the case where the social workers are meeting with the appellant, presenting to the appellant tasks, reminding appellant by phone call, by email, in paper. It was an attempt to duplicate and triple the work so that there was opportunities.
Why is there such an emphasis then on he was mailed the plan And that comes from Appellant Counsel. She says, well, he just had a plan mailed.
Well, as included in the case plan in the signature block, it said given to appellant directly and mailed. One of the concerns in this case is that appellant would frequently during the district court hearing say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I didn't get this. The agency was being as transparent as possible, providing multiple avenues for appellant to be able to review the plan, to respond to services. The agency, in addition to the plans, also provided an extensive letter update, including all of the service reference referrals for appellant, to follow up with parenting education, to go for domestic violence programming, individual therapy, all the requirements under the case plan, and appellant did not follow those. And from the agency's perspective, they wanted to remove any barriers for appellant. If appellant was not remembering when they talked directly, that there would be a written record provided to appellant, and that appellant could then follow up with those services. And I would note under the case plan, in the June 21 case plan that was filed with the court, there is this statement that was cited in the briefing that the services will assist in ensuring that the services and skills are in place to parent a child with special needs and a history of trauma. That is the direction of that case plan and parent detail. I would note that following that sentence, there are 8 domain areas with 26 additional sentences under those 8 domain areas with further direction for appellant of how to address these concerns. I would note that those 8 domains are child's functioning and behavior, child's medical needs, child's educational needs, developmental needs, history and past experiences, religion and culture, community connections, and preserving relationships. And under those 8 domains, there are, again, 26 different directives for the parent, for appellant, to follow through, to look at what does this look like. Ultimately, as you all know, case plans are not a check-the-box practice. Case plans are there to provide the best and clearest indication for a parent in how to reunify, or in this case, to place the child with appellant because there was no reunification that was going to occur because appellant had never provided day-to-day care for the child. And yet the real goal is behavioral change and addressing the concerns, specific concerns of this child, this extremely special needs child who needed IEP care, behavioral and emotional support, individual therapy, psychiatric care, psychiatric medication, day treatment, had a provider at the school who met with the child 3 hours a day, 5 days a week at the beginning of this case because of concerns of the child's behavior of hitting and attacking other children, extreme emotional outbursts, having to be called frequently to come home, along with night terrors, threats of suicide at the age of 6, wanting to cut off her fingers and wanting to die. These were extremely significant behavioral concerns that this child had. And the agency, is, as reflected in the case plans, lists those concerns out and lists a task of what it looks like to address those. Those included attending IEP meetings, being in contact with the medical providers for the child, going to be in contact with the individual therapist, the psychiatric provider for the child. All of these were provided at length to respondent, or sorry, to appellant. That was also demonstrated at trial and the district court's order. The court is finding that appellant had these opportunities to connect and simply did not. He was not engaged with those providers. Appellant loves his daughter, cares for his daughter. I don't think that was ever in question in this case. It was whether...
Can I ask a question about NAK, which, of course, you've outlined in your briefing, and it was also stated by appellant counsel. Do you think this court, as a reviewing court, needs to even discuss the parameters of NAK?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no. And we argued this at length before the district court. This was raised at the beginning of trial. The district court judge, Judge Smith, raised this case and asked for parties to brief this case and then argue it before the court. From the agency's position, this case is inapplicable to this child protection proceeding. And this is ultimately what the district court found in the oral findings made on the record following our argument. That NAK relates to Section 257, custody matter, and Section 518, involving dissolution. And as Your Honors are well aware, in that case, it was a mother who had deceased and then had directed custody to her brother and his wife. The father in the case asserted that he should, the adjudicated father, that he should have custody and that there should be a presumption. In that family court matter, there was no pending child protection matter, and then the central holding was, following the death of a custodial parent, the surviving non-custodial parent is entitled to custody unless the presumption is overcome by extraordinary circumstances of a grave and weighty nature, indicating the best interest of the child require that the surviving parent be denied custody. Even if this court were to weigh in on NAK, which we do not, we are not advocating for, we do not believe it's applicable to child protection. The central holding has never been applied in a child protection matter, published or unpublished.
I do have some concerns because NAK is not the only thing we look to. It's not necessarily even the starting point. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case based on substantive due process that really informed the NAK decision. And so it seems like whatever constitutional layer there is something that might impact our analysis. So I think there are two questions that I have about the applicability, if you want to use that term. The first is it seems that there may be, in cases applying NAK, they almost always talk about a fit parent is entitled to this presumption. And so there may be a threshold determination about the fitness of a parent in order to receive the benefit of the presumption. And so that's my first question, is whether or not that is, as a legal matter, something that the agency believes needs to be determined, if it is, in fact, a presumption that would apply to these kinds of petitions.
Well, and thank you, Your Honor. Respectfully, the agency would, in the family court context, under 257 and 518, I think the agency would have no problem with the court having a fitness requirement under NAK to have a non-custodial parent, when the custodial parent is deceased, have to be fit. I know that the court crafted language about the extraordinary circumstances that may sort of get to the standard you're speaking about, Your Honor, about such as the special needs of a child that dictate conferring custody on individuals most able to care for the child. I would note that in the family court context, preponderance of the evidence standard. It's not a clear and convincing evidence standard. That under Rule 24.01, Subdivision 3, custody matters when there's a child protection case are deferred to the child protection case first for resolution and then back to the family court case. And those differences are important. We're before the district court because there's a child protection matter, because there's an extremely traumatized child in the care of the custodial parent that needs protection or services. And when that occurs, the agency then has to assess whether that child should remain with that parent or be removed. As opposing counsel points out, under 219, the agency is also required to assess whether a non-custodial parent is in a position to care for the child. In this case, the agency did that at the beginning of this case. The agency spoke with the...
I appreciate you bringing up some of those statutory provisions that would apply in this case and not in a 518 family court matter. And I wonder if, as I mentioned, this is sort of goes back to the Troxell case, the U.S. Supreme Court case that under substantive due process found this presumption should be there and was considering, I think it was a Washington state statute at the time. So I guess the second question is, do you think there's any daylight between whatever the substantive due process standard might be or layer and what is now in our Minnesota child protection statutes? Because as you point out, there are these statutory provisions that sort of require extra consideration, not just standard of proof being higher than in a 518 case. So do you think there's daylight between those two, or do you think that our statute now has fully incorporated whatever right there might have been under Troxell and the substantive due process analysis in that case?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that that's certainly open for debate. I think that there are, I can clearly see how there would be two sides to view that. As for daylight between the two, I mean, substantive due process is such an important right for all, particularly in the context of the family relationship. And yet, in looking at how the Minnesota statutory scheme is created, we have also a duty in the child protection statutes to work with non-custodial parents for placement. And so there is...
The agency must assess their fitness and goes through a process that may not have been there in a family case.
Right, exactly. There are specific requirements for the agency to follow through. The agency in this case did follow those requirements. The agency met and attempted to meet met frequently with appellant, also attempted to provide appellant numerous times, prompting referrals in multiple ways to try to reduce any barriers for appellant. The agency worked in a case where the children, frankly, have been in out-of-home placement for over 1,100 days at the time of the permanency decision to do everything that it could to try to make the situation work with appellant. Ultimately, the agency supported the relationship of the child with appellant, but determined that the appellant was not in any position to care for this special needs child due to all of the concerns that she had. Appellant's denial of those concerns and, frankly, inattentiveness to address any of those concerns with any of the service providers.
Why would, assuming that there, the constitutional issue wasn't raised in this case, but assuming that there's an overlay of Troxell and due process, why would a non-custodial parent's fitness be measured only under a preponderance of the evidence standard? Wouldn't the non-custodial parent get the benefit of the constitutional support, presuming that that parent is fit?
And your time has run, Mr. Jensen, but please answer Judge Ross's question.
Thank you. I believe there is certainly an argument that the clear and convincing standard is more protective of the non-custodial parent than a preponderance standard, that if a district court in the family court context says there's a preponderance, this parent is not fit, that would be a lower protection for parents than the clear and convincing standard that the agency must determine or must prove in order to say that this child is needed protection or services and it's in the best interest of the child to be placed in an alternative placement.
Well, if I could, I know his time's expired, may I follow them?
Yes.
I'm talking about the non-custodial parent. I'm not talking about the standard that applies to determining that the child needs to be in protective care. I'm talking about now that that decision has been made, determining to whom the transfer of parental rights goes. So we have, in this case, a foster parent with no constitutional rights to the child, a relationship with the child, and a biological father who does.
And specifically, so if I may answer, the question that Your Honor is posing is, would the constitutional protections for the non-custodial parent in this context be protected in the same way that they may be in the family court context? I would assert that they would. I believe that for the non-custodial parent, they are appointed counsel, which they would not necessarily be appointed in the family court context. They have the own set of rules and statutes that they can argue under. There also is, again, this...
No, I'm talking just about the standard, but the decision. You mentioned that clear and convincing evidence is necessary in order for the child to be deemed in need of protective services. But I'm talking about, does that standard apply also when it comes to not placing the child with the biological father?
Thank you for clarifying that, Your Honor. I believe it does. I know that the opposing counsel raised that the standard was unfit to parent. That is not a standard that's anywhere in our statutes or rules.
Mr. Jensen, again, just relating to the standard of proof, mm-hmm. and perhaps the burden of proof relates to that. So standard and burden of proof when a non-custodial parent in this permanency phase makes a request, or in this case, I think filed a petition to transfer custody to himself, at the same time that the agency has made a petition that custody should go to the foster parent. So you have two competing requests. Mm-hmm. I think both were filed petitions. So let's assume we're talking about two competing petitions. What is the standard of proof and the burden of proof on the agency's petition on a transfer of custody, and what's the standard of proof and burden of proof on a non-custodial parent's petition, if you know?
Well, I believe the burden is the same. It's very clear that it's clear and convincing evidence for the court to determine a permanent placement under the child protection statutes in Minnesota. And so there is certainly a heightened burden for the parent if they in their transfer of custody petition to prove with themselves. But there are also added protections within the child protection code and rules to help support the parent through that process. And that would be our position. I don't know that I've exactly addressed your question, but I hope that was somewhat
sufficient. Thank you for answering the additional questions. We appreciate your argument, and we will now hear rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Ann Morris Carlson, and I represent Appellant Father PC. Reasonable efforts go beyond mere matters of form, such as the scheduling of appointments to include real, genuine assistance to help the parent become able to have the child placed in their day-to-day care. Respondent is talking about providing written case plans to the father, possibly having meetings with the father, but father still coming to every court hearing and saying, I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. Providing a written case plan outlining that you're supposed to understand your child's special needs and then mailing father, providing an email when I'm not sure what father's capacity for gaining information by way of reading it is. I don't know that he learns best in that way. I have concerns about his...
That have been brought up, though, in trial court. You know, I'm getting things in the mail, I don't understand it, and that's the problem we have as far as our review at appeal.
Your Honor, it sounds like respondent is telling this court that father was saying at every hearing that he didn't understand what he was supposed to do, and that...
But I think respondent's saying that in the context of saying why that's not something that either the district court believed or that we should believe, because he was provided, there wasn't any argument that he didn't have the case plan. He knew what was in the case plan and was still saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And you know, barring the district court reading in open court the case plan to him, I'm not sure, you know, what else the agency needs to do to show that the father had knowledge or had an opportunity to know what's in the case plan.
Well, efforts that go beyond mere matters of form would be efforts that include discussions that happen outside of the courtroom about what progress has been made and what progress has not been made, and not using child special needs diagnoses as a test. As a father, you know, demonstrate that you can care for child by listing off her special needs diagnoses.
What about attending the IEP meetings at the school as a specific statement in a case plan?
And it's unclear to me. It's unclear to me in my position exactly how much effort was put into getting father to the IEP meetings, recognizing that that specific argument might not, likely isn't properly preserved for this court. The argument that I'm making is that the agency did not make reasonable efforts to meaningfully assess father, and that in light of that lack of reasonable efforts, I'm not saying it's the reason they filed the transfer of custody petition, but they would.
I think, and I appreciate your candor with us about what might or might not have been preserved and whether we're now in the interest of justice, so I do appreciate that, and I thank you for that, but even if this was something that was preserved, and even if this had be in a TPR context, there are cases, including recent ones, that discuss whether we can look to the requirements of case plans, that they be signed, that they be provided in 30 days, or we look to something more substantive in determining whether a deficiency amounts to a failure to provide reasonable efforts. And so we're still looking at those questions and whether the deficiencies here would amount to reasonable efforts. And it seems that given the number of the case plan, we have cases. There was no case plan signed. It didn't matter. Or didn't amount to failure to provide reasonable efforts. Cases that, you know, more than 30 days passed. And so there even cases where there was no case plan with an incarcerated parent. And so the question is more substantive about what opportunity did the father have to know what's in the case plan, more than just did the county or the agency follow the requirements of the statute regarding the case plan?
For this court to affirm a termination when there is no case plan, it's in a really extreme situation. RMM, the parent, has affirmed multiple times that they don't want to have parental rights. I think there's another case that's the exception is that the father murdered the mother, but it's very, very rare. It shouldn't... the case plan burden is on the agency.
Right, but it doesn't necessarily amount to a failure to provide reasonable efforts if there is evidence that the parent knew what was in the case plan or knew what things they could work on.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I am asking this court find that based on the fact that there wasn't a case plan filed within, may I finish answering the question?
Yes,
I'll be brief. Based on the fact that there wasn't a case plan that complied with Minnesota Statute 260C.212 within 30 days of removal, based on the fact that there is evidence before this court that father struggled with understanding his case plan, based on my read of these case plans as being more of a test to demonstrate parental fitness than a meaningful effort towards reunification. On the totality of the circumstances of this case, I'm asking this court to find that the district court's findings, to the extent that they complied with the required findings under 260C.517, are unsupported as far as the district court's finding that the agency made reasonable efforts with regard to my client. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing today and arguing in support of your briefing. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. Thank you.